G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Adam White, who just laps this sporting world up. Whitey, good morning to you.
Good morning, Harf. Yeah, always love the US Open. And we have some big names at the top of the leaderboard. Justin Thomas in the clubhouse at 5-under. He leads. Patrick Reed is at 4-under. He had a hole-in-one during his first round. And then Rory McIlroy at 3-under. So that's the top three at this stage. So clearly the scores are better than what was predicted.
Yes.
John Rahm is at 2-under. So that's sort of your main fare at the top from a big names perspective. From an Australian perspective, unfortunately, we've got to scroll down to a tie for 43 with Adam Scott in the clubhouse at plus one. Lucas Herbert through 12 holes is plus one. And Cameron Smith through 11. He's made a birdie.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. So he is officially the leading Australian. Cameron Smith is at plus one. Jason Day is at plus two. For Tiger Woods fans, he is at plus three, but he went bogey, double bogey for his last two holes. So he'd be a bit flat with that finish. But Justin Thomas, as it stands, leads at 5-under.
And then Lucas Michel is 5-over through 13 as well. He was 2-over through 10, I think, or 9. So things have gone awry for him there at Wing Football. We'll talk more about that with Ben Everill a little bit later on this morning. Great to have you with us always, Whitey. But always a pleasure on a Monday and a Friday to welcome the services of one of the finest Essendon football players in the history of its magnificent club. Well, it's probably overstating it. The club's pretty ordinary. But Adam Ramanauskas is a fine human and a terrific footballer, and he's these days manager to the stars. Good morning, Rama.
Well, it's not overstating it. It's correct. And you said it, and now it's officially on record. So I'm taking it from now on. Good morning to both you and Whitey and to our listeners. And just straight off the top, Half, I've got some concerns.
Well, talk to me. This is unusual for you to come in hard.
Look, I love my man Adam White. I do love him.
We all do.
But
it's his birthday week.
I only comment on Twitter when I feel it's really necessary. Really, really necessary.
Yep.
Now,
yep.
I understand that our great man had a birthday earlier in the week.
He did.
And
43.
People like to call them birthday weeks now. You don't get a birthday week. You get a birthday day. That's it. One day. One day. Like, your birthday isn't the week starting what was the week starting this week? The 10th of September or whatever it was. You get one day. And then if you're on a 5-2 diet, which is fine, that doesn't mean the 5 days you just go and do what you want willy-nilly and just eat what you want and pile things on your plate. And because those 2 days, they become really difficult when you are fasting and not allowed to eat a lot.
True, true.
I've never seen more jam or more cream on two scones in my life. In my life.
Well, there was a post yesterday from our man that did suggest that it wasn't a fasting day. And that's what we learned yesterday, I think, Rama. Thursday is normally the fasting day of the 5-2 for our man.
Mm.
But there did seem to be an extraordinary amount of cream and jam involved. In the right order, jam first and then, of course, the cream. You never go to cream first and the jam. That doesn't make sense, but someone talks about that. There did seem to be an excessive amount of both of those condiments on the savoury item there. So I don't know where he's at. I'm with you.
Well, you and I deeply care for this man, and we want him to continue to improve. Deeply. We deeply care. But this is just ridiculous now.
Adam, are you okay?
I'm just listening to this. I'm very comfortable with where I'm at. There was a situation, Adam, that my birthday was on Wednesday, and a decision was made on Wednesday night that rather than fast on the Thursday, which is normally the case, Monday and Thursday, I would push that back to Friday because there was so many good things that hadn't quite been consumed on the Wednesday. It would be silly to just watch them on the bench or in the fridge or in the pantry on the Thursday when they had to be eaten. So that's what happened. So I had a Devonshire tea set up on the Wednesday for afternoon tea. Half appeared to be a little bit sort of unsure of what that actually was. So I just had to celebrate the following day. And then, you know, I just said, this is what's doing. And, you know, if you're going to put jam and cream on, you put lashings of jam and cream on. You don't muck around with it. If you're going to do something, you do it properly. So the scones and the apple tea cake that were consumed on Wednesday were consumed again yesterday. And now today, I have to go through the torture of 600 calories. And that's the great thing about the 5-2 diet. It's interchangeable. You just choose 2 days. They can't be concurrent days or consecutive days. And this week, rather than Monday and Thursday, it's Monday and Friday.
What do they say, Harv? Temptation is the root of all evil?
Yes. Yes, and my word is...
This is the beauty. This is the beauty of the 5-2 diet. 2 days, you torture yourself. Normality on the other
five. 5 days, you just go hell for leather?
No, it's normality.
Normality, Adam.
Normality.
Yeah.
Right. I'd be interested to ask our listeners how many times a week they are consuming scones with that much jam and cream. I'd just be interested. That's all.
Well, to start with, raspberry jam, that's a fruit, so that's okay. There's no dramas there. A punnet's worth of raspberries on the two scones. Anyway, doing some charting at the moment. This 5-2 diet once again is working, and I've talked to Harv about this.
He has.
Not that he necessarily needs to go on it. This is a winner. It is an absolute winner, and I'm very excited about it. It works.
But I'm just a friend that has some sort of concern. Yep. You know, the feedback from one person on Twitter yesterday, I'll leave him alone, it's his birthday week. That's rubbish. Yeah. You get a birthday day, that's it. That's it. Yeah. It's not this celebration of...
There were leftovers.
Yeah. You know you
that's
have
resourceful.
Children. You know you have children.
They're not getting that sort of stuff. That's quarantined.
I came across some information yesterday. I was concerned about your intake and the system you were running there and what you were calling the Devonshire tea. And I wanted to find out more.
This is good. Yep.
So I worked out that, of course, it's originated in the town of Devon, the county of Devon in England.
Well, there's some conjecture there because Cornwall will say that Cornwall was big on the Devonshire teas as well as their neighbouring counties.
They're trying to claim a right to the title is what I read yesterday, Cornwall, but... It's not called Cornwall Shire Tea, so they're not getting it. It's pretty straightforward. In Devon, the method, is what they do in Devon, boys. The method is to split the scone in two, cover each half with clotted cream, in brackets, silky yellow cream. I don't know what that means.
Yep.
And then add strawberry jam on top. Now, this is what I found quite interesting. Whipped cream and any other jam flavour is not usually acceptable.
Mm.
So don't be thrown in the whip of your cream, and don't be throwing in apricot jam or a marmalade or any type of other strawberry jam. Was it strawberry or raspberry? Raspberry jam. Don't be having raspberry jam on your Devonshire tea. It's got to be clotted cream and strawberry jam. Otherwise, you are taking the mickey out of what is a fine established meal.
Well, mine was a Big Bash style Devonshire tea, just changing it up a little bit, adding a little bit of razzmatazz.
Well, you can't call it Devonshire tea then. You can call it Templestowe Shire tea.
Well, I don't care what they do in Devon. You don't put cream then jam. It has to be jam then cream. So, Cornwall
Devon's
setup.
Where it comes
I think
from.
Cornwall
you don't
setup
care.
Is more. Well, no. I got into trouble actually last night because I had the scones at about 4:45. I had an incident on the telephone.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a phone call situation with Foxtel, and I was a bit stressed. And then Jemima had some off cuts, and then I was told don't let her have any because she won't eat her dinner. And then of course she didn't eat her dinner, so I was in a bit of trouble.
Fair enough, too.
Anyway,
how did your phone conversations go yesterday with a couple of those companies? How do I describe them?
Long. I was arguing with a robot at one point.
It's important. Good stuff, that.
Yeah.
I've done
and
that.
Was there a... Oh, gosh. Was the situation fixed by the end of the 2 hours and 37 minutes?
I wouldn't
know. No, it wasn't. No. So the interesting thing today is I'm going back again on a calorie-deficient day. So it could get quite interesting.
I did notice reading a few of your messages when you put the tweet out there that one of those companies did come back to you and wanted a DM from you.
Yes.
Did that happen?
Did you DM them?
Well, again, they're robots. They're not real people. No. I like to speak to people.
Wasn't sort of an Angie and Aspendale sort of sliding in the DMs, is it? Not sort of that activity, was it?
Yeah, well, no. Don't even know who she is.
Oh, he plays coy. He plays coy, our man. Coy, our man. Very, very coy. But Angie knows who he is. You bet you she does.
Hey, Half, one other thing that I noticed last night watching the football.
Yes. We should. And by the way, for those playing at home, Eagles by 15 points, 49 to 34 in a high-scoring affair.
I just want to run a couple of stats by you, Whitey, just because I know you do sometimes like stats.
Well, I do know that Callum Archie missed a goal from the top of the goal square, which would have put it over 15.5 points in the try bet. I know that happened. With about 10 seconds to go.
Yeah, but Jack Zeeble missed one around the corner when he could kick straight in front.
The game's called football, last time I checked, yeah?
Yes, correct.
Yeah.
North Melbourne, 360 disposals, 164 kicks, 196 handballs.
Really embraced Ron Barassi's handball after halftime grand final 1970 sort of stuff there.
So Josh Simpkins, 5 kicks, 20 handballs. Luke Davies, Uniac, 7 kicks, 17 handballs. Luke McDonald, 13 kicks, 15 handballs. Sean Higgins, 9 kicks, 14 handballs. Sean Attlee, 5 kicks, 14 handballs. Todd Goldstein, 5 kicks, 13 handballs.
I thought it was very smart from Reshaw and North Melbourne last night because they knew that they couldn't beat West Coast if they took them on in a bit of a shootout. So what they tried to do was bore West Coast to the point where they were actually in the game for a fair portion of the night, because that's the only explanation for what happened last night. That would go in the top five worst games of the year. And it's a good list.
It was a hard watch.
It's a good list.
Yeah.
It's got a bit of depth to it, that list.
Well, three-quarter time, they were even Stevens. Was it 30? What did they kick in the last quarter? Just the one. 3:10 they were at three-quarter time. So 28 points apiece at three-quarter time, and they should have been three or four goals up. At least three goals up, I reckon, the Kangaroos. So they were, if that was the plan, to bore them and just keep the ball off them with handball, and that improves your disposal efficiency too, Remmer, normally. That was a genius plan. In the end, it was the Eagles' three goals in the last term that blew the game away. But it was a tough watch. I don't know what we're expecting outside of that, but it was a tough watch, the game last night.
I've got a question for both of you who have played in those conditions up in Queensland. It's not like it's changed. It was the same 25 years ago as it is now when you play games in Brisbane. But there seems to be more of a focus on the conditions and what players can't do in those conditions when they have never changed. So are we just in a situation where players are being asked or being coached or just choosing to play a high possession brand of football with a lot of handballs, which will see the ball fumbled a lot more as a result, that they're not actually playing to the conditions, that they're trying to go against the grain? Or are the players not as skilled as they were 25 years ago to cope with the conditions? Because Liam Ryan doesn't seem to have any dramas in marking the ball or picking up a loose ball, whereas there seems to be a lot of players that do have that trouble. So what's your view on all of that?
My view is that while the conditions haven't changed, the game has changed and the way it's played has changed. So there's always a lot more numbers around the ball, which gives you less time to execute your skills in dry or wet conditions, but in slippery conditions, it does make it more challenging. So I think the way the game is played puts teams and players under more pressure, and therefore we see more errors and the like. Where back in my day, back in the old black and white days, there would be space. There would be a 1-on-1 or a 2-on-2. There might even be a 3-on-3 one stage, but there'd never be a 12-on-12 around the contest, and you wouldn't have to execute your skills in that sort of pressure. So I think that's an element. I think there is absolutely some merit in what you say regards to the overall skill level. Now, they're much better athletes and powerful and all that sort of stuff. But I think there is an element that the olden day players, so to speak, did have a propensity to be able to deal with conditions much better than the current day players. The other thing that annoys me about that, Whitey, is that this isn't exactly a new phenomena in season 2020. Like, we've had all year to play in these conditions and play the slippery footballs and in those climates, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. So that's one thing that does concern me a little bit. So that highlights my statement that perhaps the overall standard of actual football skill has not improved.
No, because, I mean, there have been a number of really good games played at the Gabba over the years, including in finals, where the standard of football has actually been very good. And you would never complain that the conditions played a major part in the way that the game was played. Now, Greta might have suggestions around climate change being an issue, but I think I think overall, the conditions are the same as they were 25 years ago, where we wouldn't be worried about the standard of a grand final based on how the game was played 20 years ago versus the way the game's played now. So, yeah, I was just interested in your thoughts on that.
What's your thoughts, Grandma?
Look, I don't think it's a big issue. We play Brisbane often in the early 2000s of a night time. Brisbane played a lot of, obviously, night games when they were right at the peak of their powers of in the early 2000s of a night time. And I've never really thought it was a major issue. Yep, there's a bit of dew, but sometimes when there's a bit of dew, it actually makes the ball stickier. Because if the ball's kept off the surface for a long time, it dries quicker and it becomes a lot more grippier. So it's probably a little bit overstated at the moment in my mind, like people sort of already talking about, oh, how's the grand final going to look when the dew sets in? It's going to be slippery. My personal view is the better players come to the fore in those conditions. When it does slide on a little bit, you know, the clean takes below the knees, still be able to hit the target by hand and foot. So I've never worried about it or never thought about it too much, but clearly it is having some sort of effect. But there's probably an element too that, you know, how often would they train in those conditions? How often would they see those conditions with a slippery ball? So, I just think it's probably a skill execution conversation rather than the weather conditions.
Ben Everill is the friend we've just phoned to get him on the line to have a chat about the US Open. First round action is currently underway at Winged Foot for the US Open, and great to have him a part of the team again this morning. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, yeah. Speaking of blokes with no idea, right? You cross straight over.
Not at all, not at all. You would have got the answer right. That's why we know. That's why we come to you and ask you questions, because you've always got the right answer, sort of like Bryden. Now, what's happening round one action? Because we're seeing a lot of red numbers, Ben, which the forecast was coming into this that wouldn't be happening too often.
Yeah, look, obviously US Opens are generally tough, and a US Open at Winged Foot is usually really tough. And we did have seven guys in the morning wave go under par, including Justin Thomas, 5-under. Really impressive start from him. The short answer to why is they had to set it up relatively easy today for a US Open standard, because they haven't got as much daylight as they usually have in summertime in the US. And we would not have finished if these guys had to have six-hour rounds. So they gave them a chance today. It'll be similar, not quite as easy, but a little bit easy-ish on Friday. They're getting a little bit of rain, they hope, so they'll keep it wet that way, or water it if they have to a little. And then they'll let the carnage ensue over the weekend. So they've basically just got to cut down to the half, to the cut, and then you'll see things get really tough again.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, that makes a bit of sense. So what's happened today? It looks as though that man who's just seemingly one of the most consistent players on tour has certainly enjoyed his first round. Justin Thomas leads all comers at the moment. 5-under 65 is a very nice way to start a US Open.
Yeah. Look, absolutely grand stuff from JT this morning. He was pretty clinical and never really looked like he was in too much danger and too much trouble. And that's hard to do in a US Open, even if they have a little bit of an easier setup. I was really impressed with that. Obviously, he's only one ahead of Patrick Reed, some people's favourite and some people's not-so-favourite golfer. He got there, though, with a hole-in-one, which is pretty impressive in any tournament, let alone a US Open, excuse me, as the cart goes past, big truck. But, yeah, like, so those two sort of were really impressive. I think Reed obviously got the hole-in-one sort of spurred him on, and whether he keeps that up, we'll see tomorrow. But some big names at the top at the moment, because Rory's just two behind JT and one behind Reed as well. And, you know, maybe being a new dad has got him feeling kind of, you know, put him in a good space.
And, Ben, what's going on with the Aussies? I believe they're none under par at the moment.
Yes, not so good for the Aussie boys this morning, although, you know, as it is tough. But it makes it look worse when those guys did go, you know, 4 and 5 under. But the morning wave at best was Scotty, I believe. Yeah, Scotty had a 1 over 71. He sort of went up and down a few times, had a chance to be a bit lower, but his putter just didn't quite cooperate on certain holes. Jason Day should have been much lower. He just had an awful double bogey on a relatively straightforward par 3 where he got in a bad lie, tried to be sort of a bit of a hero and ended up in another bad lie, tried to be a hero again and ended up down a false front and off the green and ended up with that double. So he ended up 2 over, a little bit worse for wear, but hopefully can make a move back. And then we've got the guys all out at the moment. You know, and in the afternoon wave, Lucas Herbert's the best so far with him and, well, him and Cam Smith there. Just 1 over with 3 holes to play. Hopefully they can sort of get that finished. And Leash, his struggles have continued. 3 over through 15. Matty Jones also struggling at 5 over. So not really the greatest start for our boys, but still a little bit of hope for Scotty and Jace if they have a big Friday.
Have you, through your travels, have you spoke with Mark Leishman, and just about his struggles and what he's trying to do to turn them around?
Yeah, look. The short answer is, during the pandemic break over here, he did nothing, except, like, in terms of golf. He spent a lot of the time with his family. He doesn't usually, like, grind out practice in practice range scenario. He, you know, he chips and putts around, but in terms of actual practice, he gets that in by playing golf. And during the pandemic, he didn't play any golf, and he didn't have any sort of, you know, matches that he does against mates and other people in the area and whatnot. So he just got super rusty, and he's been trying to sort of dial it back in, but just hasn't been able to do it. And then I guess when you start pressing and you start pushing for things that aren't quite there, it gets even worse. So he's just got a few bad habits and hitches in the swing from the time off. His body shape changed just a little, which doesn't help when you're doing these things as well. And now he's just got to find a way to sort of fight through it, he said.
What's it like this US Open, Ben? I mean, there's no crowds, and I know we had the PGA a few weeks ago, but this is another step up again with the US Open, such a famous event. And also, will the course play differently because there are no crowds? Because you haven't got crowds potentially trampling down the rough or crowds potentially, you know, being hit and the ball going back out onto the fairway. Will that play a factor at all come the weekend?
I believe so. I think it's a huge factor across many, many reasons. I mean, a minute ago, you guys could hear a truck in the background just going around delivering some food or something. Like, you'd never hear that. You'd hear fans everywhere. And also just the atmosphere of the place too. Like, now, Colin Morikawa is an absolute star and he's going to be great, but I'm not sure he would have had the same finish at the PGA had there been thousands and thousands of fans screaming at every guy who was making a birdie down the stretch, given there were like 15 guys in contention at San Francisco. Same could be said here. Without that sort of energy, the guys that are up the top, usually the stars, sort of struggle to keep that going at times, and the guys that are sort of lesser known don't get as nervous. I feel like that's the case as well. You know, John Rahm, for instance, he's been world number one but hasn't won a major. The fact that there's no fans could help him when it comes down the stretch, because he won't be sort of reminded as much that he hasn't won one. And especially New York fans, who like to let people know everything. and then as far as the trampling down, as you said, like, that's absolutely the case. And sort of Bryson DeChambeau, for one, he said he's going to try to overpower, and he's been trying to do that a bit. He's playing well. He's 3 under through 12. But he's taking a risk trying to get the lies in the rough when he misses, because there are no fans, there are no trampled down areas, and so there's going to be more balls sink down rather than sort of sit up on patches. You know, there were a few times where guys were out in spots that normally would even have grandstands, things that would be in the way, so they'd get free relief. They're used to that sort of thing, just, you know, taking a hack at it, knowing that if it runs through the back of a green, they'll get a backstop. It's not there for them at the moment, so it definitely has changed them.
Well, let's have a look at the first leg of the Quaddy. It is race number 6 tomorrow. The Aquas, Jim Maloney's stakes for Pinch of Poo, and who can get enough of that? It's at the moment, there's 12 going around in this one, Dino. Thermosphere number 1 has been scratched.
for the James Cummings yard. But Mozzie Monster, who I heard John Sadler give a massive push to yesterday with Michael Felgate on Racing Pulse, is favourite at tab.com.au.
Yeah, and I think she probably should be, Daniel. Her two wins have been in different styles, different tracks, wet track, dry track, and overcame a track bias to win last start. She's pretty good, and I think on her home track, she's going to be hard to beat again. But for the quaddie, I'll include a few because these are different form lines, and they're only lightly raced fillies. Agreeable number six, I'm a fan of. I think getting to 1,400 is going to suit. Two, Aidensfield ran well at Moonee Valley. She's just got an awkward draw to overcome here. Seven, Melicorn. I thought her maiden win at Kilmore was exceptional. She probably stayed at the shorter trip and covered a bit of ground, but really hit the line well. I think 1,400 is going to suit her. And one that won very well at Sale, number 10, Melba Storm, might be just an improver. The stable won the race last year and beat a horse called Singing Sword, and that horse won at Echuca by a big margin yesterday. So that's a pretty immediate form line, and I'm putting Melba Storm in the quaddy. But, I'm with the market. I think Mozzie Monster's the one to beat.
All right. So Johnny Sadler gave it a massive push yesterday, Quinny, with Blue Eyes. He said he'd be getting involved if he was punting these days, but he's not. What's the market saying?
He has got some of the all-time great punting stories as well. Mozzie Monster currently a $3 favourite. Aidensfield's been a firmer, $6 into 380. Agreeable's been a firmer, 5 into 480. And Melbourne Storm's firmed at longer odds, 26 into 14. Dino, do you think that punters will gravitate to the $3 with Mozzie Monster because she is unbeaten, or is there a touch of the fact that her two wins have been in earlier grade and we've seen the next couple in the market do really well on a Saturday and all those runners quite prominent in some of the feature markets?
Yeah, look, I think beating older horses last start was a pretty good effort, and the fact that it is a stakes race, but the top rater is a 73 rater, so you know they're only progressing through their grade. So she's absolutely in the right race to keep going. So I think with the confidence around her, and as long as you can see in the first few races that they can make a little bit of ground, because I think she'll settle off the speed, you'd be pretty confident she's the one to beat.
All right, that is the first leg of the quaddie over the 1,400 metres. And Rammer has one job for those first-timers. His job is to tell us what exactly is happening and which numbers are Dino's numbers for its leg of the quaddie. So, Rammer, can I throw to you, please, and find out those numbers again for race six, the first on the card tomorrow, first of the quaddie at Caulfield.
Yes, you can. Race six, 4, 6, 2, 7, and 10.
4, 6, 2, 7, and 10. All right, let's get to race number seven, the Katnax Jewelers MRC Foundation Cup over the 2,000 metres, $160,000 up for grabs. Now, 14 going around. Is it 14 going around or 16 going around? 16 going around, I think, Dino, because there's been four scratchings, yes. And all the emergencies are going to get a crack, it looks like, at this stage, which is most unusual at this stage on a Friday morning. But midway through the field, Order of the Garter for Danny O'Brien, D. Oliver, in those famous Lloyd Williams colours, is favourite at tab.com.au. Hasn't broken through for a little while, but there's cups on the horizon for this one, so you want to be winning soon.
Yeah, and I think tomorrow's the day that he can probably do it, Daniel. He's only had three Australian starts. He ran very well behind Furion at Flemington a couple of years ago. Then he had the long spell, the two runs back. Flemington was okay. I thought the last start was excellent. That was a really good run. And it was from a wide draw, and he went a fair way back. I think from barrier four, he can race a lot closer to the speed, which suits him. And I think he's the one that'll win his way into the Caulfield Cup. Dr. Drill's a strong danger, though. He ran on the same day in the Heatherley Handicap, and his run was outstanding. And he, too, has come up with a better draw, so he'll be a lot closer to the speed. And I think they're the principal chances. Then 12 De Beer, who is just a really honest horse and from a good draw can race well. And 14 Gamekeeper, I think he might be a better Flemington horse, big track horse, but he ran well here last start and he's built a really good record for the McAvoy Yard. He's next best. But yeah, I think Order of the Garter and Dr. Drill are your key runners in the race.
All right, so Order of the Garter and Dr. Drill, they are numbers 9 and 3 for you playing at home, but a few others that Rem will remind you of shortly. But Quinny, what about the market? Is it open, or is this Danny O'Brien staying stable, got the market by the ghoulies?
has been the best backed runner order of the Garter. $4 into 370, back to 380. Dr. Drill, a $5 second elect, then Gamekeeper on the next line of betting at 750, with the fascinating runner in the race for mine, Canane. Now, Dino, it's yes. well documented they knocked back some big, big money for Canane. Since that point in time, the horse is without a win in three starts. But if you take away all the talk about that fact, is he still ticking over for some nice races, potentially over more ground?
Well, maybe. He has got... His first three career runs were okay. He had that spectacular win in the Packer Plate where he did record good figures. And then he's had three runs that are in keeping with that, with the rest of his form. So at the moment, he's a little bit of a one-hit wonder. And he's probably got to... You know, if he's going to be in a feature race like the Caulfield Cup, he's really got to do it tomorrow. But I just can't come into him until I see him put that similar under the Packer Plate on the board again.
Maybe the old song from the Steve Miller Band, Take the Money and Run, might have been the way to go, but it's a little bit late now for that. Steel Prince was absolutely superb, beating Surprise Baby in the Andrew Ramsden. Hasn't had a lot of luck since. How do you think Steel Prince is going along again, maybe for a race over more ground?
Yeah, he's ticking over well. He's got a naught next to his name, but he ran through the line very nicely first up. And the key here is he's drawn a good gate, so he won't have to go right back because he does race best with cover. He's the one I reluctantly left out. I just think he might need this run, but he's certainly not the roughest.
Hey, Dino, we talk in AFL circles about the outlier. What's real and what's the outlier? And Melbourne obviously come up a fair bit in those conversations because was 2018 the outlier or... It was 2019 the outlier. It looks as though 2018 was the outlier. Do horses have really positive outliers, just one-offs that they explode on the scene like Canane did there for the Packer Plate and then disappear? Or is that normally an indication that there is a fair bit to work with?
Well, yeah, if the scenario is right for him, he's got that sort of talent. It was a good speed, he drew well, he cut through the field and everything sort of went right. So given the right scenario, he's got the talent to capitalise on that. But the first two runs this time in have been slowly run races, which haven't suited. Yep. He has recorded good late sectional times, but he doesn't seem to have that capacity to race much closer. So he needs, he can't dictate the play, if you like, Daniel. He needs, you know, he's got to let everything unfold right for him.
Okay, that's good information for the punters out there listening. Rama, can you please tell us those numbers, please, for the second leg of the quaddie?
Yep, race 7, 9, 3, 12 and 14.
9, 3, 12 and 14 for race 7 tomorrow at the Heath. Let's get to the third leg of the quaddie, which is race number 8 tomorrow. The Group 1 affair, the feature event of the card, the Sir Rupert Clark Stakes, $500,000 up for grabs. A full field of 16 going around. The four emergencies just hanging on for grim life, just trying to get a run in this Group 1 affair. And you don't have to go too far to find the favourite for this one, Dino. And after last start performance, wait for age, Group 1 level over the 1400. Behemoth, no surprise, is favourite at tab.com.au.
Yeah, he's a terrific horse, Daniel, and he's really putting it together this time in Behemoth. Both of his wins have been good. I love that he could take up a fairly prominent spot last start, and there'll be a heap of speed on in this race. Whether it's out of habit or not, I always gravitate to the lighter weighted runners in this race. And the one that I think's had a really good build-up for this to have a big peak performance is Banquo, number 16. His first up run I thought was sound. His second up run, he raced a bit keenly first up. Second up, I thought last week he ran well. And I just think on the quick backup with genuine speed up in front of him, he'll be running probably fourth or fifth, no further back. Good draw, good jockey. I think Banquo's got a terrific each-way chance, but giving good hopes to 11 Age of Chivalry, runner-up in this race last year. I think he's ticking over quite well. The 3-year-old 15, Tagaloa, it's a bit of a challenge for the 3-year-olds. They've had good record in this race when it was a really big spread in the handicaps and they were right down in the weights. He's still got the 54 kilos here, but he ran well first up. He'll be fitter. Behemoth is a must-go in. He can certainly win. And the other two I'll be putting in are Superstorm, who might be the best horse in the race, but 1,400 around Caulfield mightn't be ideal. And Dollar for Dollar, who was runner-up in this race 2 years ago when he was on a seven-day backup, exactly the same sort of preparation. I think he'll run really well. So as an open hand, as a feature handicap should be, it's very open, but I'm leaning to Banquo.
What'd you make of, just before we get to Quinny, what'd you make of Dollar for Dollar's run last week? Because it looked pretty good to me. Just tailed off a little bit, and Zutori got to buy a half a length. That looked pretty good to me, that Dollar for Dollar run.
Yeah, well, he's a fast one pacer, really, if you break it down what he can do. And that race was a very much a slowly run race and just a dash home. Yep. So he wasn't really suited to that. But tomorrow, with Be Good to Your Mother, Streets of Avalon, Dollar for Dollar himself, and a couple of others, you know, riding the speed, he's in a lot better sort of scenario than he was last time.
So Quinny Dino's looking around Behemoth at the moment. Is it a firming favourite at the tab or an easing favourite, this five-year-old gelding?
A firming favourite. $5 into $4.20 since Wednesday to head the market now from Age of Chivalry and $8 second leg with Tagaloa. Tagaloa 11 into 8 since Thursday of last week, was well supported when the all-in market was available. Banquo a $9 chance, Superstorm at 10. Dino, you mentioned last year's winner Be Good to Your Mother as one of the runners that will be up on speed. How do you anticipate he'll go third up into the assignment this year?
Well, you can tell he's been targeted at it again, and his form is very similar to last year. He got beaten, well, it's exactly the same. He got beaten 2.85 lengths in the Memsie last year and this year, running sixth on both occasions. But this year he's got 58 kilos. Last year he had 52. Whether he's a 6 kilo better horse 12 months down the track, I'm not so sure.
Do you think his form's just as good and it's going to be a case of the weights getting him in a handicap race like this and could just stick with him for something else? Or do you think this race might even be a bit better than last year as well?
I think this is a better race than last year. And I often find that, look, he's a terrific horse, but often their biggest win is nearly their last win because he's, you know, everything was, you know, aligned for him to win last year. And he'll run well in these sort of races and he'll run well tomorrow, but I haven't got him as a winning chance.
And you mentioned Jai McNeil aboard Banquo. Jai McNeil, for mine, one of the most underrated jockeys in the country. What could a win like this do for his career?
Oh, well, he won a Group 1 last year on Kingsville Dream, and he was the leading Victorian rider by number of wins. So his profile's building, and, yeah, he's a real chance tomorrow, and he'll be riding in all the feature races, I'd imagine, over spring, especially with very little international and interstate participation.
Nice work there, Quinny. One of our listeners telling us that James Cummings said to Michael Felgate that Raheran will be running in Sydney, so we'll keep an eye on that scratching as well. So we'll, of course, as we always say, Friday is a good day to sharpen the pencil, but really drill down on Saturday with the panel on RSN 927. So this gives you a
and
chance.
Daniel, you mentioned that Raheran probably isn't running. The first emergency is the really good value chance in the race, Harlech, so it'll get into the field with a bit of luck and run a good race for the Moroney stable.
All right, keep an eye on that as well. It's number 17. Rama, what do you got for us, please, in the feature event on the card, the Sir Rupert Clark Stakes?
Race 8, 16, 11, 15, 1, 5 and 6.
Let's be tagging winners in the last leg of the quaddie. How about we do that? It's the How Now Stakes. Over the 1,200 metres, Group 3 affair for the mares, and we've got some well-known names aboard this one. Dino, 13 runners at this stage, and in the middle of the field for the Anthony and Sam Friedman yard, we have Liar, a well-known horse to most racing punters out there in the last couple of years. Very firm favourite in the market at $2.50. Do you agree with that summation, Dino?
I do indeed, Daniel. I think she is clearly the one to beat, Liar. She hasn't won since that Blue Diamond victory at this track and distance about 18 months ago, but her last three runs, the only three runs she's had in blinkers, and two of them were Group 1 placings. First up, second was a beauty. She's back to mare's grade. Because she hasn't won for a while, she's got the limit weight in the set weights and penalties here, so she's beautifully placed to win. I'll be putting in a little bit of insurance. Our roughie from a few weeks back, Miss Old Mantra, everything went wrong that day. She just found trouble mid-race and was eased down, so take no notice of the zero next to her name. She's trialled well since. Damien Lane sticks with her. I think she can run well. And I'll be putting Spanish Whisper in, who I think's trialled really well in preparation for this. But Liar does look very hard to beat.
All right, very firm in the market, Quinny, there at the tab. $2.50 is pretty strong, and I imagine might even get a bit tighter.
Well, that's a really good question. 270 into 250, and Dino sounded pretty bullish there, so yeah. I dare say the support may continue and that 250 may be sure to come race time. Dino, what sort of quote do you think Liar should be?
No, I think she's about her right price, but as I often say, it often depends on the results of the day. if the punters are flying along, they might just soar right into her and she'll get in very short. But about 250 is, I think, about the right price.
Okay, hopefully can get the job done there in the lucky last on the program. Now, you've left out the second and third Alexia, the second elect Felicia, who was terrific last start, just pipped by Showmanship, and also Hummer Hummer is the question mark with Hummer Hummer, the 1,200 metres, where she's just one from 10, or have you basically just got a couple ahead of them both?
Yeah, Hummer Hummer is a place chance. I'd loved, if she'd have drawn a decent gate, she'd have had a better chance, but the outside draw and 1,200 metres makes it a bit more complicated. And with regard to Felicia, she got a very easy time of it last start. And I just thought this race with She's a Thief, Our Campagna, Gentico, In Good Time perhaps even, there's a bit of pressure to her inside. So I just thought that would make her a bit vulnerable late.
All right, so it looks pretty straightforward at the end of the day in terms of the numbers for the Quaddy Rammer. What are they again, please?
Race 9, 6, 8 and 1.
6, 8, 1. Pretty straightforward finish to the day. Oh, you know, I've just received a message. This bloke, Fennecum, he sleeps in every week. Every week he sleeps in, this fella that I know, Rammer. He needs to know the numbers. Can you please rehash the entire set for tomorrow's Quaddy legs at Caulfield?
You need to tell this bloke to set his alarm earlier. Okay, race 6. 4, 6, 2, 7 and 10. Race 7, 9, 3, 12 and 14. Race 8, 16, 11, 15, 1, 5 and 6. And then race 9, 6, 8 and 1.
6, 8 and 1 in the last. Good SMS coming through as well. Lance Armstrong running in the last. Liar. So a bit of an omen bet for Dino's numbers there. Nice way to finish it off. Let's get to the formula bet today. Now, we've got a special one today, Dino. I'm going to tell you who you're playing for, and you can give us the numbers and what we're going to win on that, and Quinny can help us out with the odds. But this week's contestant is Jodie Burgess from Bang Home. Now, Jodie, we've been made aware of her situation through her husband, Anthony. Jodie has, according to Anthony, major medical issues. She has MS and stage 4 metastatic breast cancer and issues with her lungs because the cancer is still spreading. Her prognosis isn't great, and there's no cure for either disease. This is from Anthony. I'm not just making this stuff up. So we thought what we might be able to do, Dino, today is track down Jodie's details and make her the contestant for your formula bet today to give her something to look forward to this weekend. She's a massive racing fan, loves listening to you, and never misses Friday morning on the Friday form. So we are hopefully going to put a huge smile on Jodie's face with a winning formula bet tomorrow at Caulfield. How can you help her out?
Yeah, I really hope so, Daniel. We'll be having $40 to win race 7, number 9, Order of the Garter, $40 to win race 9, number 6, and that's Liar, and of course $40 on the all-up of the pair, race 7, number 9, into race 9, number 6, and as you mentioned, that is for Jodie Burgess of Bang Home.
Good luck to you, Jodie. Race 7, number 9, race 9, number 6. Quinny, what can you help us out with there in terms of the multiplication at the tap?
Well, I think we just need to give a times 5 this week. So why don't we maybe tinker with the system a little bit and times the collect by 5, win, lose or draw, and hopefully get the result done there, because that was very touching to hear that little story there. So hopefully Jody can have a little bit of luck together, and we better roll the dice. What's your best in the footy this week, Harf? I'm going to put you on the spot.
Cool.
Where'd that come from?
This is a new addition to the Friday form. This is a new, let's do that.
You can have a think about that for a sec while I read out the all-up. We've got $3.80 Order of the Garter, all-up $2.50 Liar, currently comes to $9.50, and we'll times that by 5 with the multiplier.
Oh, we'll times that by 5. That's almost 50. That's almost a 50 to 1 there for the formula bet for Jody, which is fantastic. Whitey, you're our footy betting man. You did the fill-up yesterday with Gareth and Mick. What's the best footy one this week?
Richmond over 15.5 points is about $1.60 against Adelaide.
Right. There we go. We'll have another 100 on that there as well. So hopefully another 160 coming. So 100 on the Tides to get the job done by 16 or more. And the, not unicorn, what's the word where sometimes you don't see it very often?
Yeah, it's like a unicorn.
Okay, the unicorn of the times 5 multiplier.
Yeah, it is a unicorn, it's the times 5.
Hey, Quinny, we just got to make sure that Calamar Cheese not having a shot for goal with 10 seconds to go to get it over the 15 points like last night.
good to see you're over that 24 hours later.
It's only about 12 hours. Good luck to you, Jody. Hope things are going okay for you today, and that puts a bit of a smile on your face. Race 7, number 9, and race 9, number 6. You can cheer home tomorrow at Caulfield on Dino's selections. And, of course, the Tigers by 16-plus in their clash against the Crows as well. Good luck to you. Dino, that only leaves us one thing to do for you right now, and that is involve Adam Remanaskis for the Ramaruffi.
Yes, and we're going to go to race 4. The favourite will be very hard to beat, but I think there's value here with number 3, William Thomas. He's a terrific Caulfield horse. He's trialled well. I think he's over the odds. Race 4, number 3, William Thomas.
All right, race 4, number 3, Quinny. What's that paying, please?
$8 the win, $2.30 the place. I dare say that will be well backed.
That is good business already. 8 and 2.30 is a good result for the Ramaruffi this week. Race 4, number 3. By the way, Quinny, thank you to you and the tab for what you've done for Jody today. That is good business. We think that's very nice of you. So thank you for extending the hand and helping out Jody with the formula bet and the footy bet as well. That's very nice of you. Dino, I can't wait to hear you tomorrow morning and then all through the day on the spring ticket on RSN 927. Group 1 racing is where you really come to the fore and really stand out amongst the other hacks out there. You are a champ. Thank you, mate. Appreciate your time on a Friday morning again.
Let's hope so. Thanks, Daniel.
Good stuff. Dean Lester is the world's greatest form analyst, and you can hear him tomorrow morning as part of the pre-show, the pre-race day action, and, of course, during the day on the spring ticket. And download the app today on RSN, or the RSN app, and listen to all the coverage tomorrow. The boys do a hell of a job. Quinny, before we let you go, what have you got for us for the best tomorrow?
Trying to redeem myself after Cadre Noir got beat in the first in Sydney last week, but I'm going to go to Sydney again. I think there's going to be a Group 1 winning filly this campaign. Race 4, number 3, Hungry Heart. Currently $2. I think we'll jump about $2.50. We'll win tomorrow and then string a few together this preparation.
Very, very keen to have a chat to Marcus Bontempelli about his game this weekend. It is an absolute cracker. The Bulldogs are sitting in 8th position on the ladder at the moment, and they've got the Fremantle Dockers, the Kazali Stadium in Cairns. This is what makes it even more intriguing, that it's the Cairns factor. The conditions up there have been quite interesting throughout the season, and the skipper of their Bulldogs, the champ, and one of our favourites, has been good enough to join us on a Friday morning. Bont, good morning.
Good morning, gents. Hope you're all going well.
We are going well. How are you going? You're living on the edge of the 8 at the moment. There's adrenaline coursing through your veins, I'm sure, and up at Kazali Stadium tomorrow against the Dockers is going to be a very, very interesting affair. In fact, Sunday, a very, very interesting affair for you guys to finish the home and away season.
Yeah, it is. I guess it's not too dissimilar to how we finished last season in terms of needing to win that last game to consolidate our position. But that, with that comes a good challenge, some excitement. And like you said, there's some adrenaline definitely, but feeling good about, you know, hopefully what we can do.
Has that been building, the energy and the adrenaline? Obviously, the position of the team would create that a little bit, but knowing that the finish line and the real stuff is just around the corner, can you feel that and sense that building within the group after what's been, a really challenging year at times?
Yeah, you definitely can. You definitely can feel, the prosperity of you know, what if, or potentially, playing some finals football. But at the same time, you've got to be quite... you know, you got to check yourself and understand we've still got a game to play, and especially with Fremantle on the way that they've been playing their football, it presents as a pretty big challenge for us. So despite, you know, what may be ahead future-wise, you really can't allow yourself to drift that far ahead. You've got to really, especially us, focus on, you know, playing our best football this weekend.
And Marcus, no game's easy, but you mentioned Fremantle, their form has been really good to finish this season. They're a really tough team defensively. You guys are obviously a really attacking team and high possession team. Where's your concern lie with the Dockers at the moment?
We'll have a look at probably their team in more depth this morning as we plan, probably preview sort of their makeup and what it'll look like. But I think when you look at, you know, how their team start, they got a lot of really young, good players who I think have got, you know, good endurance, good sort of speed. You know, like I said, they've got a lot of dangerous sort of players that can influence the game in big ways. So we're going to have to be cautious of probably how they move the ball as well, and not just think they're a, you know, potentially defensively minded team, but work out how we can, you know, use our different gears and different ways to build the ball up to get through them.
You've only lost, Marcus, once since round 11, and that was to Geelong. And even your last three losses have, in fact, your last four losses have been Richmond, Brisbane, Port Adelaide and Geelong, but you've banked the wins outside all of that. Do you feel, as we get to this point, that the team is playing as well as it has at any point during the season?
It certainly feels like we've played probably a better style and brand of football for longer. And as you mentioned, a lot of those teams are probably up there. They're at the top end of the ladder, and we've had good probably patches and good periods against them, but probably the Richmond game being a bit different, we didn't play well at all probably for not majority of the game, but a fair chunk. But the other three, we were sort of in the game and just couldn't quite hold on or capitalise on some of the momentum we've had, and probably learn from that in trying to keep our momentum up, stay in the game and stay in the moment so we didn't have those lapses. So I think that's definitely helped us, that period we've been able to learn from and adjust from on the fly, and that's helped our last few weeks of football, and obviously put us in a position where we can potentially take things a bit further.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Marcus, we were talking earlier this morning about the much-talked-about conditions, particularly in night games in Queensland, about the ball gets slippery and we're seeing a lot of mistakes and all that sort of thing. Do you try and play the same way in wet conditions, or do you genuinely have a different game style compared to if you're playing in a day game versus a night game?
Yeah, I definitely think we'll make some adjustments because the conditions are quite different. And as you mentioned, from a, especially just a ball use point of view, it's going to be hard to, assume things will connect and will play out the way you probably anticipate from inside the stoppage, from a handball perspective, then forward. I think we've actually spent a few years at Cairns in previous years playing, and we've played a lot of sort of twilight night games. So we're not, in terms of, how familiar we are with the conditions, we are somewhat because we know what it's like, but obviously haven't played there for a few years now. So you do have to adjust, knowing that the ball will be a little bit slippery at times and you might not be able to punch, handballs into space or areas or as fast as you might normally. So it becomes maybe a bit more of a kicking game to get the ball forward. So we'll probably talk about those adjustments today, but you do have to make some changes, I think.
What about the rhythm of the season? Sorry, Bont, Remo, I'll just jump in. What about the rhythm of the season, Bont, in the way that's been unfolding? 4-day breaks, 5-day breaks, and there was for about a month, and then there was a 7-day break in between there. Then you go back into the shorter breaks, and now you got a 7-day break into hopefully a finals campaign with a week off in between. Has your body started to adjust to the shorter breaks, and now these extended breaks, a 7-day and then hopefully a 13 or 14-day break if you win on the weekend, might throw it out a bit? Are you concerned about that at all, the way that the body's reacting to the rhythm of the year?
Not really. I guess in your body now probably thinks after 4 and 5 day breaks that a 7-day break's a 10-day break. So yeah, you do, I guess, as a mature body, your body just reacts a bit better to probably the ebbs and flows. And I think the football club and we as a whole have done a pretty good job to sort of set ourselves up to cope with the changes and adjustments. And what the longer breaks do give you a better chance to train some things. So on the 4 or 5 day break, you really don't have what we call a main session where you can actually improve or practice some of the things that fall out of the previous week's game that you might want to work on or touch up, but it doesn't give you a great chance to do that. So as a young team, sometimes the training elements of being able to fix or feel like you're ironing out some kinks is really beneficial. So I think we've done okay in that regard, but the longer breaks do give you a bit of a chance to train a little bit more and put some things in place. So once we probably got out of that pretty sort of frenzy period and have had some longer breaks, it's definitely helped from that point of view.
With those shorter breaks, Marcus, were you doing a lot more video analysis sessions, or was it really just about recovery and just going from game to game? Because you talk about being a young team, and it's critical that you continue to improve through action in training. But as you're saying, you can't do that. So was there a lot, because you're in the hub, you're together, and you can, I guess, a coach can grab you whenever they really need to. Were you doing more video?
To be honest, not really, because I think you've got to try and strike a really fine balance between, you know, overdoing it and clearly being in a hub and surrounded by probably, you know, football in a sense so much. It was, you know, important for everyone to feel like, you know, they were still mentally, you know, had the same amount of energy and application that they could. So we probably weren't doing any more than we normally would, but obviously trying to identify, you know, maximise the time that we spent together as a group so that when you're away from training or when you were just chilling out, you didn't feel compelled to be connected to the game so much. And that way, just to keep everyone mentally fresh as much as physically.
A 15-point margin was in favour of the West Coast Eagles, and the North Melbourne Football Club finished their season after the home and away rounds with just the 3 victories for the entire 17 rounds. And they are in almost some danger of, depending on what happens, now who knows what might happen. Adelaide could beat Richmond. They could almost win the spoon or grab the spoon at the end of the season. Boomer Harvey's the champion of the North Melbourne Football Club. He won't like me talking about that sort of stuff. He's the AFL Games record holder. He's a big part of our Friday footy preview. He's back again. Good morning, Boomer.
And good morning, boys. And you're spot on, Daniel. No, I don't like you talking about that. I don't think the Kangas have ever actually won a wooden spoon, if I'm...
Is that right?
I'm pretty sure, but I don't think that's going to happen. No one thinks Adelaide can beat Richmond this week, and if they do, unfortunately for the Kangas, they will win their first wooden spoon. But last night was much better than what we've seen. And you mentioned at the start there, half, that the Kangas only won 3 games for the year. The disappointing part about that was we won our first two.
First two, yeah.
So when the COVID hit and they went into the hub, and we only end up winning 1 game out of the next 16, which is really disappointing. But last night was a little bit better to watch anyway. I know we didn't get the 4 points, and that's what it's about at the end, but it was a little bit better to watch, put it that way. Especially
what did you like about last night? What did you see in the last game?
The slightly different style. I think you would have seen that we didn't kick down the line as much. So there was the ball movement. There was a little bit of a focus on the ball movement from me. I still think that there's some youth coming through that you can play with. Murphy looked okay last night up forward. Even Durden last night, he's a backman, and they put him forward. They just tried things. And as a coaching group, yeah, got nothing to lose. So I think they obviously tried a few things, and I didn't mind it.
Okay, 1-3 wins for the season for the Kangaroos. Bit of a change in round 18. Now, I've just been handed some information, Boomer. Now, you're right. The Kangas have never won 1 wooden spoon. They won 13 of them.
13.
13 of them.
Well, I thought I'd throw it out there. because I know Joey or someone in the background would have dug something out. But 13. Jesus.
Now, they are the second...
That was Buddy. Was that Buddy 13?
That was Buddy 13. You betcha it was.
I think I played that game.
Against North Melbourne.
Yes. Down at Sunny Hobart, Launceston.
Beautiful part of it. Well done.
Ripper so day.
Only,
that was a ripper
only
day, that
the 13
too.
Spoons for the Kangas through their time.
No, we've been
in the
around
game.
For a long time. We've been around for a long time. So, yeah, well, what I meant to say is that we haven't won as much as some other clubs.
There's only one club that has taken more spoons than you. Who is it, Rammer?
Please say something.
Right, Bulldogs? I might ask somebody else. You
got Maradona there. Got Maradona.
I went Western Bulldogs.
Well, okay. Now, that's your answer. Who's won more spoons than the Kangaroos?
St Kilda.
That is correct. On 27.
Yes, St Kilda.
27 spoons for the Saints. That's a lot.
Yeah, Boomer, a serious question for a moment. With the North Melbourne scenario now, what happens? Do they blow it up and start again? Because they've already got 3 picks inside 25 with the way that they'd banked a first-round pick from last year's draft. Do they just go real young, or will they just slightly build? What do you think they will do, and what do you think they need to do?
Well, I think if I was running a football organisation, I would go now. When you finish on the bottom part of that ladder, I would go to youth, but I would also bring in a player from another club, 1 or 2 every year. And when I say they've got to fit the demographic of the group, I wouldn't be bringing in a 27, 28-year-old because they're a gun and they've got 4 years to go. I'd be bringing in a really good player at 22, 23. Because I still think our core group of young kids coming through, Jermont, Simpkin, Mackay, these type of young kids, Luke Davies Uniac, these type of young kids are all 20, 21, 22 years old now. So I would add another player at a similar age bracket that has been around for a year. So pay him a little bit extra to get him out of the club, bring one or two of them in a year, and then go to the draft and bring three or four more in. But there's no doubt that the football club have to go now to looking at the list and getting rid of certain players. Absolutely, there's no doubt about that. So that's what I would be doing if I was running a football club. Not just North Melbourne, but running a football club. That would be my philosophy on list management.
Is there a standout category that you need? Is there a key defender, running defender, key forward, goal sneak, outside runner, inside ball? What do you need? If you had one category, where would you go, Burma? And in fact, I'll throw it to all you blokes.
Yeah, I'll go first. I think a key back, because Robbie Tarrant's not going to be around forever, and he's our best key back by a long, long way. You know, he's one of the better ones in the competition for me. So we need another key back to be taking over from Tarrant. I think we haven't got a small forward that can kick goals. We've got young Jack Marnie coming through, but he's only 18 years old, and you can't put pressure on him to kick two goals every single game. So I think a small forward would be ideal as well for North Melbourne. A key backman, as I mentioned, and probably I would still be adding a little bit of pace up on the ball. So we've got a lot of good insiders in Cunnington and Simpkin and these type of guys, but I would be adding like a Brad Hill type of player. You know, we've got Aaron Hall, who looked like he could link up again last night, was running really well. Another player similar to that who could use the ball, a really good ball user.
And I think Boomer's hit the nail on the head, but I mean, the reality is they need players probably in all three areas of the game. So I can't really ask Rammer this question, so I'll ask you, Half. With those three picks that I talked about inside 25, Ben Brown's worth at least one first-round draft pick. So that gives them four inside 25. And if he was to go as a restricted free agent, the compensation would be first round. What do they do with Jared Polek and Sean Higgins?
Well, Polek, they're locked in for another 3 years with Polek at big money, aren't they? Isn't that the deal?
Well, they are, but they can get him out and North Melbourne will pay some of his contract and another team might pay 500 and North pay, I don't know, 200, 150, around that vicinity.
I don't know if that would be the ratio, but I don't know how bad it is in there for Jared Pollock and whether or not this has just been a year for him to reset his goals and reset what he actually wants out of footy. But it seems to me that if you're going to go to a club on a big deal like he went to the Kangaroos on, that you really invest and you commit to that opportunity, to that length of time, Boom. Now, is it untenable, his relationship with the Kangaroos? It's not fair to do so. But
no.
Is it untenable or can it be dragged back?
They won one game in 16 and he's sitting in the stands on $700,000 or $800,000 a year.
Clearly there's a statement being made, but Stephen Kelly is on $7 million and dropped?
Yes, he was brought to the football club under different circumstances. He was still there when Brad Scott was there and it was a situation where North Melbourne thought they could be competitive. Now, it's a different coach and I think the outlook is very different for him now. So the circumstances have changed dramatically. If a trade can be organised where North Melbourne can get a pick even in the 20s for Jared Polek, and then, you know, I'm not sure the situation with Sean Higgins, that my point is that North Melbourne could have five picks inside 25, and their circumstances can change reasonably quickly when you add those picks to a group of talented players under 22. But does that leave them too light from an experience point of view?
I'm just throwing those
scenarios up as questions.
You're too young, and that's been proven on many occasions. When you're too young, you can't get the wins. And then what clubs, the better clubs do is they pick apart those young sides and get the better young players when the club's developed them for a few years. So I agree with Boomer. Yeah, go to the draft by all means, but also try to get some really good, you know, 22 to 25-year-olds from other clubs as well with those draft picks.
So Rama, is Sean Higgins, is that now his lot in life, that he's going to be part of a developing team and that's it? Or does he look and go, well, geez, I might only have 2 years left. Am I better to try and get to a team that's contending next year?
Oh, well, that's up to him, I suppose. And if a team wants him at that age now,
you're not going to pay much for him. This is the thing with, you're not going to get a top 25 pick for Sean Higgins because everyone knows the leverage isn't there.
Yeah.
It's more if North Melbourne feel like they need to do, well, the right thing's not the correct statement here, but if they feel like that he's going to hold a younger player back from playing a number of games. I think, like, you know, with Sean playing on a wing that he has most of the season, does that hold back a, I don't know, let's use Taran Thomas as an example, from playing up on a wing rather than playing on a half-forward flank?
Yeah, and if you've got the Polo situation, why do you, if he's causing unrest within the club or it's not working, people ask questions why, and they might not want necessarily that player at their club. So you lose your leverage again. That's the problem they've got, the Kangas, at the moment with those sort of players.
A little bit careful on the Sean Higgins thing, and this is only my 2 cents worth, obviously, but I think you've got to be really careful of just getting those players out. And Rami, you mentioned, is he holding back a young kid? Well, for me, and this is, again, my opinion, if he's better than that young kid, he's not holding him back. That's the way, right. I say it. And I know the clubs do have a look at 2 years down the track and say, rightio, should Taran Thomas be playing on the wing? Yeah, Higgins is holding him back. Let's get rid of him. But he's a very, very, very good player, Sean Higgins. So I think it's up to Higgins more if the puzzle piece fits to another club. Would he look at that and not so much North Melbourne doing it?
I hate the conversation with, oh, we've got to get 50 games into these young kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, give them 50 games if they deserve 50 games.
When they deserve it, 100%. Yeah.
But see, Sean Higgins has been pushed out to a wing rather than playing where he would like to play. Now, he's 32, but in a way he's a young 32 because he has missed a fair bit of footy through illness and injury through the years, and he can play multiple roles. I'd be looking at Sean Higgins if I was in contention next year. Absolutely.
I'm not looking at anyone but Friday night footy. That's what I'm looking at. Let's get to that game. It's St Kilda and the Giants. It's an absolute cracker. Both teams hanging on by a thread or trying to hang on by a thread in the finals race for 2020. In for the Saints, Dan Hannanbury straight back in. Good effort from Dan. Jack Carlisle, another big in for them. Hind and Zach Jones goes out injured. And for the Giants, Jake Riccardi back. I would have played him last week. And Stephen Camilio, yes. I would have played him last week. Anyway, they're back in. The skipper is back in after 1 week out. Adam Kennedy and Harry Himmelberg has been omitted for the Giants. Boomer. The Saints are sitting in seventh at the moment. Percentage inside the eight. The Giants are a game outside end percentage. This could be something else. What do you see?
It could be, and I totally agree with you on Riccardi. I think he shows some really good signs. I know you can't fit them all in, and probably that's why they've dropped Himmelberg this week to get Riccardi back in. But I think he's a player and a really good player of the future. So one to watch, certainly. Rama, help me out with the percentages here. If St Kilda win, they can finish fifth or sixth.
Yeah, the Giants have to win by ten goals, and have the Western Bulldogs and Melbourne lose as well.
Okay, so last week I debated whether the Giants were going to make the finals, and I said they're locked in. This week I agree with you; they're going to struggle to make the finals if that happens. So 111.4 the Saints are, and 100.6 the Giants are. I think it is. So that's about 10 goals.
Yeah.
It's about 10 goals they need to win by. They won't beat the St Kilda Football Club by 10 goals, that's for sure. I'm liking what they're putting together, the Saints. That next young group are coming through of Steele, Clark. I put Billings in there, but Caulfield. These young kids are starting to look really good, and you add a little bit of leg speed in Hill. Jones has been a great recruit. I know he's out tonight, but he's been a really good inside recruit. I just want them to start taking the game on a little bit more like they did at the start of the season. It looks like they've got into their shell just a fraction, but I'm liking what they're doing. Their ball movement is good. Marshall, with Ryder in the ruck, he's working for me because one can push forward and make a real men's up there. Gresham's a big one for me. If they had Gresham, I think that they would be, maybe not a contender this year, but they would go deeper into the finals. I just mentioned those young guys, and I'd love to see Whitey, Half or Rama have an opinion here in round Steele, Clark, Caulfield. When the heat is on in the finals, and they haven't played a lot of finals, those guys, or finals at all, will they be able to stand up? They've shown in the last 12, 13, 14 weeks that they've been really, really solid contributors. When the heat is on, will they stand up in September? So that's the question I got over the Saints. And GWS, Tarano, Hopper, have these guys taken that next step, Rama? How do you see Tarano and Hopper?
Taranto, I'll give him a pass because he came back. He obviously had the shoulder reconstruction. He worked really hard to get back. So I think he did just a great job to get back this season. Hopper's probably been, he hasn't got better from last year. But I still think he's going to be a very good player. To answer your question on Clark and Caulfield and Steele, well, there's only one way you've got to find out. They've never played finals before, so you've got to throw them in the heat of the action. Both look like they're capable. Clark did a couple of things a few weeks ago in a really, really tight game late in the fourth quarter, yes, where you just go, really, yep, this kid's got what it takes. Caulfield, I think, has been steady all year. Steele looks like he's made for finals, just the way he goes about his football. So tight game tonight, but I'm going to go with the Saints tonight. I've picked GWS all year. They'll probably win now, but Whitey, I'm going with the Saints.
Yeah, it's a very difficult game to pick. I'm actually a bit worried about St Kilda in the sense that over the last month they've lost, or the last four games, they've lost three of those four games, but they were in winning positions in all of those matches, and under pressure, they couldn't get the job done. And even the Eagles, 15 points last game, they got themselves in front in the last quarter and they kind of froze with the moment and the opportunity that had presented itself. Whereas the Giants can freewheel a little bit tonight, kind of the pressure's off a little bit, and they can really just try and take the game on and do what they haven't been able to do through a lot of this year. So for me, I am going with the Giants to win. But it's more about St Kilda not being able to take the opportunity than the Giants being in overwhelmingly good form.
This is it's a great point you make, Whitey, because the shackles are off. Now, we see this year a lot of teams, they're playing stranglehold football for three quarters.
Yeah.
And we've seen it with Geelong a couple of weeks. I think it might have even been last week. They kick one goal till three-quarter time, and they come out in the first 6 minutes, they kick another three goals because they have to win the game. Is that the case for the Giants tonight, but it's not in the last quarter? It is at the very start of the game, because if they don't go out and play decent football, they're not going to kick a big enough score, their percentage is not going to grow, and they've got zero chance or donuts of making the final. So the shackles need to be off from the very first second.
Yep.
So we'll see a different Giants team tonight. You watch their ball movement. Their ball movement will be up the guts. We know that they've struggled inside 50s all year, and the quality of the inside 50s. Yeah. You watch the inside 50s tonight.
You know this, though, Boomer. It's hard to switch it on and off like a tap.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, Rammer. I do, but I like the shackles thing. I like it because teams have done it all year in that last quarter, and I just think Giants are going to come out tonight and their first quarter will be completely different to what we've seen. They've struggled. They've been really low scoring this year for a decent team, and I bet you they come out and kick a few, or certainly have shots on goal.
But you're right, because if they don't, they're no chance. So a chance, they have to go big early just to set things up. So
and
you
watch the standard of football. The standard of football will be completely different, and it's going to be a great game tonight.
I'm with you, Whitey. I'm on the Giants tonight. I hope St Kilda win. I actually hope St Kilda win, but I think the Giants will. Who knows where that will leave the ladder after round 18 for those two teams. We'll see. So you're going for the Saints, Boomer?
You know what, Half? I'm actually exactly the same as you. I hope the Saints win, but I think the Giants, if they play that freestyle of football, they can win. So I'm going to go with the Giants as well.
All right. Giants for you, me and Whitey. Rammer's gone the Saints. Let's get the other tips before we get to the break and come back with a Friday face-off. Essendon, Melbourne. Interesting. I love this because all of us selected Essendon in round 3. Are we going to change our tips in round 18? I certainly am.
I certainly am.
Melbourne. What are you changing?
No, I'm definitely Melbourne.
Yeah, right. We're all in Melbourne there. Richmond beating Adelaide, or Adelaide a chance, boys?
Richmond. I hope not. I hope not. Number 14 for the Kangas. No, I'm going with Richmond.
All right. Brisbane and Carlton is Saturday night action as well. I'm on the Lions.
Yep. I'm interested in selection here, what the Lions do, but I'll take the Lions.
Yep, Brisbane for me.
Hawthorn and the Suns on Sunday. I'm on the Hawks. Boomer?
Suns.
Yeah, Gold Coast through the midfield.
Hawthorn and the Suns. Stratton. The skipper's going out. They'll win that.
Gold Coast.
No, Hawthorn by 15 goals. Sydney and Geelong on Sunday as well. I'm on the Cats.
Yep.
Cats.
Geelong for me.
And Fremantle and Western Bulldogs on Sunday night. Ooh. Dogs for me.
Dogs just have. They have to.
They have to.
Dogs. Dogs just. But Freo's a good bet. Good odds.
Let's not forget Monday night, Collingwood and Port Adelaide. I can't see the Magpies beating Port.
Ooh. I think it's going to be a better game than people anticipate, if the way you said it, Daniel. I'm going to go with the Pies.
Yeah, I'm taking a risk. I'm going the Pies.
Port Adelaide.
That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.